Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football Sports Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats Magazine is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. Find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Yes, Bob. So happy to be on. So good to hear your voice and your introduction. Every once in a while it gets me wondering, how did you come up with your introduction? Your foot, it's iconic. It's become iconic. It's right up, you know, it's right up there with, you know, just, you know, football commentators, you know, touchdown, goal. You know, it's, I mean, just, you know, big bang, come on. It's iconic. And while you were running through it, I'm like, how did he come up with that?
Many, many years ago when I was on the Leatherhead, when we actually started the show on the Leatherheads of the Gridiron Network, they asked me, can you do, you know, want to do some sort of introduction for your show? And I said, sure, I'll write up something. And at that time, I came up with a couple different ideas. This one sounded the smoothest, in my opinion, when I delivered it. And it had the touch of the nostalgia of the game, so I decided to go with that one. And you were the actual first person who ever heard that introduction that night on our first show when I introduced it.
I love
that.
That
was 8 years ago. Eight, 9 years ago. It's been a long time.
Good luck, man. Yeah, I just love it. It has literally just become iconic. It's just I know the show's starting when I hear that introduction. It's just I've joked around about getting it into a ringtone, but it's the show has begun when Bob says football. I won't even do it justice. I won't even pretend. So I love it.
I'm glad. A lot of people enjoy it, and it gives that nostalgic feel to the show, and that's what I'm trying to do. And we're trying to do on the show. We talk about football history, football memorabilia, and it is, you know, we present it in a way that it's going back in time. But before we go back in time, we got a tale of two quarterbacks right now with the two teams that we root for. We have Aaron Rodgers, one of the more wealthier men in America after the contract he signed. And your quarterback for many years with the Seahawks is in a situation where he's going to probably be on oxygen on the sidelines for most of the game, trying to get used to the altitude over.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I read about Danger Russell Wilson getting traded on VFC. I forget who broke that, but I hadn't had a chance to read my news yet that morning, and I was like, no. And there's always the rumors, but Russell Wilson, you know, brought the first Lombardi trophy to Seattle. It's just at some point, he's your guy, but, you know, he's been doing it for 10 years. He's starting to lose a step. And I keep going back to Bill Walsh, 49ers iconic coach, trained many of our, you know, existing coaches, Holmgren, you know, et cetera. I mean, Seattle Seahawk, great coach, Mike Holmgren.
Yep.
That was for you, Bob. Bill Walsh trading Joe Montana for Super Bowl.
Yep.
Later releasing Jerry Rice. At some point, you're like, it's a game, and when the players lose talent, you know, Johnny Unitas, even back in 72, 73, traded to the Chargers. You know, Broadway Joe Namath. You know, it's just,
yep.
Todd Tobias's beloved Lance Allworth. You know, I mean, just you think about all these iconic players, and it's just sad. So, I mean, it's part of the game, but you always think that your player's different. You know, Russell Wilson, the Seahawks also released Bobby Wagner, little-known future Hall of Fame linebacker.
The way I look at it, the NFL has, evolved into a massive multi-billion-dollar business, and it's run based on business decisions rather than loyalties or anything else that goes into the game. I look at the Green Bay situation in which you are basically governed by a board of directors who only concern is basically keeping the shareholders and the fans of Green Bay happy in a way. So I can understand what they did, and I'm sure there was a lot of behind-the-scenes tooling to keep Rodgers there. And again, a lot of people don't realize Brett Favre, when he was let go from the Packers, he was offered literally a lifetime personal service contract with the Packers to just show up basically a few games a year or whatever the schedule was, or a few, X amount of home games, X amount of away games, be an ambassador for the Packers. And you're gonna get like whatever it was like $3.5 million or was some incredible figure of money for 20 years, and you reject it because you want to play the game, you still feel you got it, yada yada yada. Well, okay, so he goes to the Jets, he shows some life there. He goes to the Vikings, he shows some life there. But you know what? He could have had it all and saved his body the wear and tear for those extra seasons he played. And he still didn't win he didn't get that next ring, but I know he showed everybody he could still play, and that was fine. We knew he could still play, but what was the point of the whole exercise,
Wear and tear, you touched on one aspect of it, Captain. Saved wear and tear on his body, but also saved a reputation hit. You know, Brett Favre leaving Green Bay, I mean, that's an iconic player leaving an iconic team. Just because he thinks he has what did he play? 2-3 years? I forget, but for a couple more years. Yeah, I think you're right. But at some point, it's like, I don't know. How do you feel? You're a Packers fan, obviously, the Packers fan.
Well,
how do you feel about Aaron Rodgers' deal where he's taking 25% of Green Bay's salary cap?
The way I look at it, and like I said to you, I know I said to you privately, my phone lit up. I mean, I thought it was Christmas, the texts that were coming in, the calls that were coming in. And, you know, I basically said to the couple contacts I got left in Green Bay, I said, Green Bay had to do this to save face. Rodgers had to do it to save face. Rodgers has always said to people, I want to play my whole career in Green Bay. Rodgers also said, I know I can win another ring. Okay, you had the best opportunity known to mankind this past season, and you play one of the worst games of your career in a total meltdown. The total meltdown of that team, the deer in headlights look of LeFleur as the head coach, which was so reminiscent of Mike McCarthy at the end. And okay, so now you played into supposedly a 4-year deal. It's basically a 2-year deal. It's all backed up. And I think what they did, they came to an agreement. You're going to play 2 years. You got to win the Super Bowl both years. If you can't bring us there after the first season, we're going to reexamine it. And I think, you know, they'll part ways type of thing. But they got to win the Super Bowl. There's no going back. There's no going back. So it's you know, again, it's the best situation, it's the worst situation that could happen. If you look at what happened with your team, Seattle got so much for Wilson. Denver gave a lot away.
Yep.
But Pete Carroll, being Pete Carroll, knows he could start rebuilding through the draft. He's going to have a rough season next year. And he knows down the road the team will be much better positioned to, you know, go back into the playoffs and go back into the possible Super Bowl and winning a Super Bowl again. So I understand.
There's a little bit of Herschel Walker to Minnesota sprinkled in this. My first instinct when Russell Wilson is traded is, damn it. And because, you know, somebody brings a ring to your team, the first one ever. Bob, you don't remember the first ring in Green Bay because you weren't born yet. But Seattle, you know, isn't quite steeped in history like, you know, the Pack. Matt Hasselbeck, you know, took Seattle to its first Super Bowl. I will forever be grateful to him. And Russell Wilson, I'll forever be grateful. So it's tough. It's nostalgia where it's like, oh, man, I can't believe they did that. Also, it's like 2 first-round picks and, what was it, 2 second-round picks. I mean, we got a lot for him, and he's a, you know, 10-year quarterback. Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, it's a business. It's tough. It's so tough. I mean, the Aaron Rodgers signing does really affect the ability for the Packers to put a good team around him. There's got to be a little bit of, you know, disdain in the locker room, if you can't sign good people because one person's gobbling up all that cap space.
Right. Well, I think what it was also, too, a question of, they know they got to rebuild in a few positions. They know the weakest spot they have is special teams. So they have a horrible special teams team. They had a bad coach. They got a much better coach now with that pickup of I can't even think of his name. The guy that played the coach to the Raiders there, whose name escapes me. So long story short, they have a good nucleus of coaching. Now, can he create something with nothing is going to be very interesting to see. The kicking game is horrific. The returning game is horrific. So I don't know what they're going to do. If everybody's going to be, you know, multiple position on special teams, and they're going to be playing, you know, second-string defense, second-string offense to save money. I really don't know what they're going to do. I don't have a clue. That was one question posed to me through the whole process of what a lot of people asked me. Well, how does this impact the rest of the team? I said, well, you figure it out. If his cap is going to be charged, and I'm figuring it's going to end up being charged between $35 and $40 million, not the full $46 million. So if you're taking that much out for him, now you really got to put together you know, some strong free agents, some strong whoever, and at the same time try to put together a, you know, a competitive team one way or the other on it. So that's going to be a long-term key there to see what happens. But like I said, I'm telling everybody, he has to deliver a ring to Lambeau next season. If he doesn't, it was not a good move. That's what I have.
You were spot on.
I hate to say it too. I can't see Jordan Love, unless he really comes around, I really can't see him being another star Favre Rodgers prototype coming in. I can't see it. He's a fair quarterback at best. He had a golden opportunity when he had to play that game. He performed, you know, a lot of excuses were made for him. But, you know, man, Rodgers could break his leg on the first quarter of the first game of the season, and you're going to have to step in and you're going to have to win the game. Simple. No going back.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, are you happy? Are you happy that Aaron Rodgers got signed? Or do you think back to that, you know, the number one seed team getting bounced from the playoffs at home?
Well, I'm still livid about it. I mean, you know my feelings on it. I mean, I posted a lot of stuff on it. I'm just saying, it was probably one of the worst coached games I've ever seen, and one of Rodgers' worst games he ever played. He looked totally disheveled and disinterested on the sideline.
Uh-huh.
Had no clue what he was doing. Your special teams in the biggest game they ever had to play looked like a junior college team out there, a Division III team.
Yep.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. It was sickening to watch. Sickening.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think very, very, very clearly, if they end up going back, they get the number one seed, they go back to Lambeau. If they lose again, then that's it. I don't think Rodgers will be back. I don't think LaFleur would be back either. Because, again, if I was the GM, I'm just going to say, hey, we're clearing house. We've got to rebuild now, and that's it. This is it.
Yeah.
Aaron, you did a great job. We appreciate it. But time to move on, man. You're going to be 40. You know, that's it.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, it's tough. But wanted to bring up a couple really good auctions closed during our interim here that I wanted to recap.
Okay.
If I could have a couple of moments. Sorry.
Yep.
As you know, I kind of started dipping my toe into the unopened market a couple of years ago. I just bought a really nice wax pack display case, hung in my office, and I've been filling it. I was sending you and a couple of the gentlemen some texts of my new office artwork wax packs, which I'm really enjoying. But some auctions I was watching in the unopened world that ended in Heritage last week. Very rare 1956 Topps wax box, an entire box of wax packs, 56 Topps, 24 packs, nickel packs, 1956 Topps, which is an iconic set, sold for $155,000. That's 186 with the buyer's premium. 186 divided by 24. Yeah, you're looking at about $7,000 or $8,000 a pack. You can pick a 56 Topps nickel pack up on eBay for about $2,000. So I was thinking this would go for 50 to 60, you know, because you could, you know, and a 56 nickel pack is not rare. You could piece that together if you wanted to, you know, and the wrapper doesn't mention, BBCE wrapper doesn't mention if it's, you know, original or if it's been brought together. What's that word they use when it's, you know, just kind of packed together? It's not, you know, not from the factory. I forget that. Collated.
Yeah. Reconditioned or repackaged.
Repacked. Thank you. I think that's it. $186,000 for 24 packs of 1956 Topps. That was a barn burner. And then the other one that I was watching at Heritage, 1952 Bowman Large Nickel Pack.
I saw that.
How many nickel packs? How many 52 large nickel packs do you think have been graded by PSA in history?
Minimal. Few of them.
It's six.
Okay.
and one PSA, so the highest graded nickel pack for 52 Bowman Large. 52 Bowman Large, the number one most collected set in PSA from that article I wrote a couple years ago, and one of six nickel packs. 24,000, 28.8 with buyer's premium, $28,000
wow.
for a pack that 70 years ago was worth a nickel. One of these days, we have to do some sort of investment portfolio, you know, analysis where it's like, if I would have invested a dollar in nickel packs 70 years ago, you know, versus a dollar in the stock market, where would it be? It's so
right.
funny.
Exactly. Well, you know, people have said that to me all the time. Why didn't you put away any nickel packs? And I'm going to say honestly, I started putting away one pack for whatever reason back in 1975. Because back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, when the boom in football cards started, I naturally am getting hammered to find out, do you have any unopened packs? Do you have any unopened packs? Blah, blah, blah. And I already said I put together a run of tops from 75 up to the current year, one wax pack each year. If you remember one of the dinners at the National in Baltimore, I opened up my 76 pack there, and I did not get anything. It was a common pack. There was nothing there. Okay. So, and then the other packs I basically sold off over the years. But in any event, I agree with you. I wondered if in each year, rather than putting one wax pack away, if I had put away two or three or four wax boxes and just kept them, and then at age such as, say, age 55, I started, you know, bringing them to the market, I'm sure my rate of return would have been phenomenal, to say the least, especially if I started in 65, you know. So it's amazing.
I mean,
really amazing.
Same could be said for me. Joe, when you were 14, why were you, you know, squirreling away 1984 tops? And the reason is because I was busy ripping them. I was busy ripping them and eating the gum. That's why. You don't really think about it at the time as this could be an investment, unless you're, you know, Fritz. But, you know, but, But I'm really enjoying my unopened wax collection lately. And just that little display case that I got, it was just, that's the cherry on top. I really enjoy that.
To me, it's a very historical view of the hobby, and you know, again, I tried to do it through my wrapper collection, which I sold off a few years back, because I had done everything I could do with the run, and I just didn't want to spend the money for the real key ones, just to say that I had a pretty you know, good collection of wrappers. I had a lot of fun doing it. They were nice display. I took pictures of them. So, you know, it served its purpose. It did what I needed to do with it, and that was it. So, but in your case, an unopened pack, you have the mystery of what's in the pack, and that's the coolest thing about it, an unopened wax. You know what I mean? So, speaking of unopened wax, at the local Big Lots store, I was in there the other day. There's some sort of brand called Exquisite by Panini, and a pack of 15 cards was $12. So I'm looking at it and I'm saying, no, this can't be. And I'm looking at the little section there, because they have about five or six different types of cards available. They have one baseball, two basketball, and the rest were the football, the playoff football. But I didn't see this one before, and I'm saying, no, this can't be. $12 for a pack of this year's cards, over a dollar a card. It blew my mind. And I should have bought a pack, but I just said, no, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. This doesn't make any sense.
Wow.
This is not fun. This is really not fun for me. So just put that in perspective. Put that in perspective. No sense to
I was at a candy store. I sent you guys a picture. I was at a candy store in Eastern Oregon a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
and they had, you know, that big league, you know, chew gum. They had all this nostalgic, you know, stuff. And on the counter, he had one box of baseball wax packs and one box of football wax packs. The football was like, you know, 2018 tops. It was junk, you know, and I think the baseball was like, I forget what they were, but it was $5 a pack. And, you know, and I was like, I love that where I'm in a candy store, and this candy store is huge. It's, you know, about 2,000 square feet filled, you know, wall to wall with all that candy you loved as a kid that the guy had the wherewithal to wax back stuff. I thought it was cool. I didn't care about the price. I thought it was a genius idea, and I really loved that it was a throwback, you know.
That's cool. Oh, unbelievable. Well, anyways, let's get into our show tonight. We're going to continue, in a way, what we talked about in our last show. And I thank everybody for contacting me about the show. We got a lot of very positive response, and listeners enjoyed us talking about the 35 Chickle set, so on and so forth. So tonight, we're going to spend some time going back to the beginning, basically. We're going to look at the 1894 Mayos, and we're going to talk a bit about the Mayos and the bridging to the 35 Chickle set. And, again, we know the Beecher card is technically the first football card, and we're going to, you know, we go back to 1888, but we're going to try to look at sets. Because if I was alive in 1888, and I know I would have picked up my Beecher card somehow, there was a 6-year gap of me trying to find the next rugby, soccer, / football cards that I could collect. So I'm in the Mayo district, and in the Mayo collecting mode, 1894. And again, to jog your memory, which I'm sure you remember, many, many years ago, you and I and a couple other people, we went in on a bid for a partial set, and I only wanted one or two of the they were SGC graded, and I only wanted the ones that were 20s or 30s because that was where my set was. And I looked back a little over the past week looking at some of the prices there, and I got a laugh at it because realistically, what – you know, in your experience, what's I'm going to go by SGC because that's what I'm collecting, and they look a lot better than in the PSA holder. What's an SGC 20 or 30 going for today? It's probably breaking, what, 400 up to 500?
Yep.
Okay, that's what I'm triggering.
Yep. So it depends on the name. If it's a Poe, double that or triple it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, or if it's the infamous Dunlop card, it's whatever the market will bear, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. But again, we go back to the good old days. We were picking up 20s for $60, $80,
$100.
I date myself back in 1988 where I bought two ungraded ones for the incredible price of $10 each, which I thought, it killed me when I wrote the check out and I mailed it. From an ad in SCD from a long gone New Jersey dealer, and I just said in the letter I had called him, and he said, I am kind of selling them. So I said, well, listen, I'll send you the check for $20 and whatever the postage was at that time was like $4 he was charging. I said, if you don't have, you know, I prefer any Yale ones you have, but whatever you have left, just, you know, send me two. And he said, I'll do it. He says, I'm sure I'll have two left by the time I get your check. So he was nice about it. He put it on the side, blah, blah, blah. So anyways, fast forward to 2022 now. We're looking at a set that, you know, realistically is going to probably cost you graded in low grade $400 to $500 a card plus the Poe plus the Dunlop if you really want to put the set together. And the Dunlop, as we know, in any condition, it's going to be a very expensive card, so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we also are...
SGC 10, that Dunlop is $8,000 to $10,000. It's an expensive card.
Right. So it's not, if I was starting all over again in 2022, putting my run together, I basically would say to myself, I'm going to attempt to start at 1948 for the simple reason it's affordable, I can get in a lesser grade, blah, blah, blah. Back in the 80s, I said to myself, well, gee, I got my little Beckett book here. It shows the 1894 Mayos. So I'm going to try to put that together. I'm going to put the 35 Trickle together. Remember, at that time, there's really nothing listed at all from 1894 to 1935. So it was a two-step process. You would try to find the Mayos, and then you would try to find the Trickles, and then you get the jump to the 48 Bowman, 48 Leaf set, and actually get into a yearly run. So today it's a lot different because we know there are different sets from 1894 to 1935, although they're not every year and they're not mainstream,
yep,
and they're not necessarily professional, we still have an ability to put cards together to continue a theoretical run of football cards from the Beecher card in 1888 all the way up to whatever year you want to stop, 1988, 98, 2008, 2022, whatever you want to do. Obviously, from 1989 to 2022 now, unless you are a multimillionaire, it's going to be difficult for you to put together all the different sets and subsets out there. So
yep,
realistically, you know, you got to pick and choose. So again, getting back to what we're saying here, you're starting out collecting. You finished your 1894 Mayo set. What's your next step before the Trickle, knowing what's out there? I'm curious.
Yeah. When you broached this subject, I was like, now I'm curious because, I mean, if you start thinking about the ones off the top of your head, I'm sure you and I would be in the same, would name drop the same. So I went and looked, and I went to the handy-dandy PSA registry. Their registry is a little more robust than the SGC one I found. Mayo,
right.
Obviously, you mentioned 1894 Mayo. The next set that's listed on the PSA registry after that, the 1907 Michigan Deitch postcards. Have you heard of them?
Okay.
Yep.
Yes, I have.
Me too.
Yes,
good looking. I've seen a couple complete sets, I think, sold via BST back when they were there. There are zero sets on the PSA registry. Zero. Not even historical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 15 card postcard set that I think is good looking. But Michigan's obviously college, so it's got the same, and these are postcards, so it's got the same knock you're going to get, you know, with the Mayo set, that, you know, it's college. It's not professional football. After that, you've got the 1909 Murad, cigarette cards. These are, you know,
yep,
animated. They don't name a particular team. Again, it's 12 cards, and it's college, Harvard, Michigan,
yep,
and powerhouses like North Dakota. North Dakota?
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So the Murad set, which is a good-looking set. I've collected a few, but not a value.
Yep.
Not a lot of value, and again, college. There's one registry for that 1909 Murad set, one. And then it's a
okay,
nice leap up to the 1925 Dominion Chocolate set. That's on the football registry. There's 12 cards in this set. It's a really good-looking set, but it's Canadian. It's Canadian Football
right,
League.
Yep.
But a good-looking set.
I really never counted that because it was Canadian and it was foreign to me. And I'm saying to myself, well, this really isn't American football. And I always talked about that with among dealers and among collectors, especially those who were pursuing it. I just said, I have no interest. I even have any interest as a type card type of situation. But I get it, though. You know, it's the next step up when you're coming from the Murads to go into the 20s,
yep,
look at that gap into 1925. So, major.
Yep. So, it's not that it's Canadian. It's Toronto. It's CFL. 12 cards. And it's a candy set. It's a W, style.
Right.
12 cards,
right.
You know, they're strips. Two collectors that collecting that set, including someone you'll know, Carl Lamadella. Carl,
who
had the number one set, or has the number one set, which it's a good-looking set. And I've always liked it, and I, you know, it was nice to kind of go in there and recap it. So thanks, Carl. Touch of the, you know, tip of the hat to Carl for having scans of the setup. I went through and looked at every single card, and I went, man, I like this set. So after the 20, after 25, now we start getting into, you know, obviously you've got the our beloved 1926 Pottsville, you know, RPPC, you know, that's professional. You're gonna get people who are like, well, they were postcards. But back then, postcards are what you did, especially for regional stuff.
Right.
But all one team, so obviously local, and, you know, and postcards. So that's the knock. That's not a national set, and we're talking about what's your next national set to come out. So you've got the, you know, our beloved 1926 Pottsville maroon set, which is the only set that we've had three people on the show discussing before. And in that same crowded company, you've got the 1926 sports company Spalding set, and that's professional, but it was a multi-sport set, golf, horse racing, all of it. And there were only 15 football cards out of the 126 that appeared on a sheet, 16 if you include the Grange promotional. You know, the Spalding is a great set. I love it. Really good looking. Love the borders. It's got 9 Hall of Famers in it, Benny Friedman, Ernie Nevers, Ed Weir, 10 if you include Red Grange. But again, you know, it's a multi-sport set. We're talking about the specifically a football set professional. So this is kind of scratches the itch because it's professional, it's national, but, you know, it's not all football. In fact, you know, just slightly over 10% of it is football. And by the way, another tip of the hat to Carl Lamadella. He's had the number one 1926 Spalding set for over 20 years. I've never seen two 10-year badges. Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Two 10-year badges for Carl. I didn't even assume what would happen if you hit 20 years, like if they would come up with a 20-year badge. But no, you get two 10-year badges, which is another thing I didn't know. So tip of the hat to you, Carl. I love that set, and good for you. And then in that same year, 1926, you've obviously got your Red Grange. You've got your, you know, your shot wells, your ad backs, and your blank backs. But that's not an NFL. That's, you know, that's a specific player. You know, it's not a specific player. It's, you know, or it's a specific player. It's meant to promote a movie, not the NFL. In fact, the one card that showed him in a professional uniform, you know, the B version that showed him in a Grange jersey was pulled. There's only two known to exist. So that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Again, doesn't quite hit it. So the next step after 1926 is the 1928 Star Player Candy. SPC. Love the set. But it's, again, multi-sport. There are, you know, SPCs of, you know, baseball players, you know, football, you know, et cetera. You know, and we know SPC as the ever-growing master list of football players. What is there, 60 players now in the master set for SPC? I think there's more, isn't there, Bob?
Yeah, I think there's a few more.
Dave Back had a huge find. Dave Back, you know, fellow collector, had a huge find about 8-9 years ago where somebody sold him a bunch of uncatalogued up to that point cards. So it's ever-growing. I would say the SPC set comes close because it's professional. I mean, it's got Red Grange in it. So, you know, there's a lot of football. It's professional. It's got Hall of Famers in it. But it's also multi-sport. So it's not specific NFL set, even though it had a very large NFL subset. Correct?
Right.
The next step after that, 1929 to 1930, Rogers-Peet. Rogers-Peet is, again, a multi-sport. In fact, there are only four Rogers Peets cards out of the 65, I believe. It was a very specific, it was regional, multi-sport. There's one Hall of Famer in there, and that's Red Grange. And I think there's only 20 examples of that. So, it's a very regional set. You had to redeem cards or, redeem things to get cards, et cetera. Some really good articles on that. And then after that, you get into, the next stop after 29-30 Roger Speed is the 33 Sports King. Again, a very good set. But when you think of the 33 Sports King, you think of Jim Thorpe and Red Grange. Jim Thorpe retired. Red Grange was still playing, but barely, had 2 years left and was, mostly playing defense. Is there three cards? Is there a Newt Rockne in the Sports King set, I think?
I don't.
No, there's
not. I got to look that
up. I don't think so.
Off the top of my head, I don't think so.
I can't remember either. Those the two bigs are the Thorpe and the Grange. So Sports King, mostly known for, mostly known for its baseball players. So again, multi-sport. In fact, less than 10% of it is football. And then after the 33 Sports King, you finally make it to a nationally distributed football-only football set, the 1935 Chickle. So a long stretch, some very, very good sets there, regional, national, college, Canadian. I would say between the Mayo and the 35 Chickle, the closest thing that comes to a nationally recognized set would be the 26 Spaldings. That's pretty close. But
I got to say this. In my collecting journey, I really did not know what was there in the gap between the Mayos and the Chickles until probably beginning in the early 90s to the mid-90s. And then when we took over the magazine, I do remember we came up with an actual checklist. I know John Spano worked on it and did most of the work on it, coming up with the actual cards that were, that could be collected during that time frame. I really knew of the only set I really knew of was the Sports Kings, and I knew that there were some football players in it, but they were so rare to me. I never saw them at any show, and I rarely saw them ever advertised. So it was like a whole new world that existed from the time frame from 1894 to 1935. Today, you got so much information on those sets now, even though they're very rare, in my opinion. You could still, read about them, understand them, view them, see samples online of them, so on and so forth. So you have a much better understanding of football card history if you choose, to go with the Beecher and then in the knock off the Mayos and then move your way up to the Chickle. So for purists, do you really want to collect four cards out of a set when the rest of the set is multi-sport? I've heard that argument over the years many times. I've heard arguments, especially with the Sports Kings, gee, I'm not going to collect it because that's a multiplayer sport and I really have no in any multiplayer set. I get it. I understand that. But then again, if you just collect football and you want to be pure in football, you're more than happy only to collect, three or four cards from a set. And that's the football part of it, so on and so forth. So with the exception, obviously, of the Michigan and the Potsdam sets, which are pure and all football players there. Another subject to touch upon, getting back to what you were saying, postcards seem to be, much more readily available in the collecting market for that time frame. You can get a lot of real player photo postcards of players that you have no idea who they are because they're never identified. You know what I mean? And you got the caricature ones of the Ivy League sets over the years. The early years, the turn of the century, 1900s, so on and so forth. that can be collectible. You have cartoon ones, so on and so forth. So those are collectible at the same time. I knew one guy years ago, he just collected football postcards, whether there was a player, a stadium, or an actual game photo on it. That's all he collected. He didn't collect regular cards. And I've lost touch with him over the years. I don't even know if he's still alive. But he was out of New Jersey, and he would spend literally the entire weekend from, anywhere from Pennsylvania, Maryland, all the way up to Maine, searching at shows, antique shops, so on and so forth, trying to find these postcards. This is well before the internet age. And I always thought that's a very cool collectible, just to collect postcards like that. Because there's a lot of really nice game photos and Ivy League photos and team photos of football from the, 1900s through the 1930s. Very, very interesting postcards that are available.
What do you think? What you think, because, as I was putting my notes together, I'm like, to me, the only oasis between the barren desert of professional football of the Mayo and the Chickle was the Spalding and the star player candy. The star player candy, professionals, quite a few. I think the football checklist is over 60, but multi-sport, nationally distributed, and then the Spalding, nationally distributed, but only 15 cards out of 126. What are your thoughts on those two? That they're pretty good sets.
Well, I still maintain the star player by far and wide. I'm very surprised there's not a greater effort by advanced collectors to try to collect it. I'm surprised there's not a greater effort by type card collectors like myself to pursue, trying to get four or five of them for their collection, so on and so forth. I think two things impact it. Number one, first and foremost, they're rare. You don't see them. You don't find them. And in a lot of cases, they're cost prohibitive trying to find them. You know what I mean? It'll be interesting to see, going to this national in Atlantic City, I'm actually going to try to find dealers and make a count, a running count, of the dealers I see that have a Beecher all the way to the 35 Chickle and everything in between. Are there going to be any dealers? Again, I know I'll see some Mayos. I know I'm confident I'll see some Chickles. Will I see a Beecher card? Will I see any of the Michigan postcards? Will I see any of the Shotwells? Will I see any of the star player? Will I see any Sport King cards? It's going to be interesting for me to see what I will actually find there and how many dealers have it, and to see how many collectors on the floor are actually pursuing any of that. It's going to be interesting to see. And I think if I had unlimited funds, I'd be definitely going after the star player big time. But again, I don't have unlimited funds. If I could ever come up with a type card from that set, that'd be fine. That'll serve my purpose, and that's about it. But there's some college players in there, too.
So it's not quite all professional football. The SBC has some college players as well, so it's a good mix.
Yeah. I mean, it's a classical set for that time frame. It has great players of that era. You couldn't really ask for anything more, but again, it's not a well-known set, number one, and B, it's not an overly collected set, number two. So I think that has it going against it. But then again, I can't see tomorrow, after this show, all of a sudden 500 people are pursuing star player cards of any sport. You know what I mean? It's just not going to happen. You know what you're collecting. You know what you like. You know what you're gonna keep up with. And like I said, I can see more people trying to just get a type card out of it, and being done. Say, hey, I got one. I see what it looks like. I have one in hand, satisfied with that, and that's it.
Yeah, totally.
I'm still kind of.
I agree with you. The SBC, the Spalding, to me, because of the SBC being, pro and college and et cetera, I think that Spalding set is the one. It's the closest you can come, and it's just because there are 9 Hall of Famers.
So I just think that's the gap, but I also believe very strongly, I still believe this, there's still a lot of postcards out there waiting to be discovered that can actually trace football from 1888 up to 1934 before the Chickles. That's my honest opinion. And I don't know where they are. I don't know if they're in private collections. I don't know if they're ever going to come to the market. But I'm just kind of surprised, in a way, besides the advanced collectors that we know, why that postcard realm is not more heavily collected than it is. It's interesting to me to wonder about it, and it's interesting for me to, again, I think some collectors disregard a postcard, the size of it, they don't want to, it doesn't fit their collection, it's not a card, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, to me, the postcard is incredibly historical for that time frame. And any postcards that can be found and collected are truly historical, to say the least. And to me, should be very, very much collected, to say the And again, I'm still unpacking my stuff. I probably only have now 20 or 25 postcards from that era, and they're mostly Ivy League cards. I don't really have a lot of a non-Ivy League postcards because I really never found them. And back in Connecticut, obviously, I am doing the East Coast because I went to Maine a lot. Looking in different antique shops over the years, that was what was prevalent more than anything else. So it's interesting, to say the least. In the time we were... I dug out here my Murads that I have, and I haven't looked at them in a long time. I actually found the box that they were in. But it's interesting. I got the Cornell. I have the Harvard. I have the Tufts. And I do have the I can't even see it right now. I have to get my magnifying out. I have one more, which is the North Dakota one. I do have the North Dakota Murad, and I find that pretty interesting. And I also have a duplicate of the North Dakota one, which was in my sale box. So it's pretty interesting to see what I had from there. But that's one set. I always liked them. I liked them because they were... they were very interesting to look at, and they're very historical, to say the least. But all right, we're winding down the time here. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? We're starting to work on our new issue, which will be out in April, issue number 76. Got a lot of nice compliments on issue 75. Amazing where the time went, 20 years, 75 issues. And our 70, next issue, number 76, very big, and there's going to be a very, very interesting article written by yourself on the, I won't disclose it, but a regional football card set, and great article. Again, I told you before, all the years collecting, I never once saw that card in person until I got to a national, and one of the first nationals in Chicago, I actually saw a dealer that had a couple of them. I did not buy any of them, but it was just interesting to see them. So, but I'll keep everybody in suspense.
Looking forward to it. Thank you for that, Kevin.
It was a great article on a true regional set, And there's so many different regional football sets you can collect on all the teams. I did find out, and I was shocked when I found out, the Packers no longer put out a police set. They stopped in apparently 2019. So their run rent from 1983 to 2019, they did not issue one in 2020 and or 2021 for whatever reason. So I was kind of floored by that because that was one of the longest running police sets.
Did the Packers police set start in 83? Because I think the Seahawks started in 79, I think. I'd have to look again.
I'm pretty sure Seattle was 79. There was a lot of sets beginning in 78, 79. That's when they really caught fire. The Packers' first issue was 83. It was more of a oversight set. But I used to enjoy back in the 80s collecting those, and I just thought they were real cool to get a complete team set of a team that I didn't see much of, and something different than other couple cards in the Fleer set and the regular Tops issue. So I always enjoyed them. I had a full run of the Chief sets every year. I was trading with a guy in Kansas City who would send me one every year. And I also traded a lot with Mike Rich over the years for Detroit Lions cards. He had police sets.
Silly question, but why did the Packers start in 83? I mean, it just seems odd that the Seahawks would get a jump on, police sets before the Packers.
I think, honestly, it was just trying to get the sponsorship for it, and I think it took them a while to get the actual sponsors because most of the early police sets were sponsored by Kiwanis clubs, police athletic leagues, the PAL leagues, and they had local sponsors. And for whatever reason, the Packers were just late in coming from it, but they ended up being one of the last teams issuing them. And I got to try to research if there were any actual police sets put out in 2020 and 2021. So it'll be interesting to see. All right, we're down to 2 minutes, Joe. Handing off to you. Yeah, pretty
all right.
Very, very good discussion
good.
Tonight.
Yep.
Your thoughts.
Yep. A couple good auctions that are popping off here pretty quick. REA is supposed to start today. Love of the Game just around the corner. Al Crisafulli, who's been a guest of the show and an advertiser, said he's got a really good football selection coming up, which makes me, twiddle my hands together like C. Montgomery Burns. And then I believe Mile High just opened their auction. They've been advertising a T206 Honus Wagner. Even this football guy will utter that baseball card. But some really good auctions popping up pretty quick, and I love me auction season, as you know.
I know. So it'll be interesting to see where the market heads over the next few weeks, and what's going to be the new hot item to collect as far as vintage is concerned. But again, tonight, we tried to gap a question that was presented to me by a longtime reader of Gridiron Greats who said, I talked with him privately about it over the years, but he really wanted a little better view of it and an actual discussion of it, so hopefully we provided it tonight with the gaps, what to collect. After you finish your Mayo set and you finish your Chickle set, what can you do in between? Now, there's a lot to do, a lot to find, and a lot to collect. All right,
we're
almost out of time. Yep. Star player. There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Joe, 20 seconds. Final thoughts.
Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, the tale of two cities, Captain. I guess time will tell. We'll know in about 2 years.
We'll probably know it next February, whoever's on the Super Bowl. I would laugh. I'll laugh my head off if it's Denver and Green Bay. That's all I got to say. All right, we're out of time. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll be back next week with another show.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.